Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-hosts, Alfred Addisk and James Corbett of the Corbett Report, will be here after the first segment of today's program. So let's get started with the market report for Thursday, August 4th, 2016. It was a little bit of a quiet day today, both in the markets, in the gold and silver markets. I think everybody is waiting for the job report tomorrow, so we'll have to see what they're going to pull out of their hat. And, they went from 38,000, and they actually revised that lower to 280-some thousand. So I figure that number's going to be a little distorted until we get over this election. But some things were a little quiet today, so you'll probably see, if it's a good number, the market will go higher until reality sinks in and saying, how does that work? Because we got some numbers here and around the world that really doesn't support that. And this is what it should be. So you might get some very unusual trading tomorrow, maybe some knee-jerk reactions and then reality strikes. Or, it might take a little bit for reality to pitch in. But and it'll be the same way with the gold market. The gold and silver seem to be touching on reality. They're beginning to show signs of, they're not going with status quo here. They're going with the fundamentals of gold and silver for the precious metals. But we did have gold manage another 320 today at $1,361, almost $1,362. Silver, a little pressure, down 5 cents at $20.43. Platinum was down 5 at $1,162, with palladium down 8 at $707. The USDX today was up 0.24 at $95.77. Crude oil was up almost a full buck, 0.97. at 41.80. Paper markets today, as I said, no change in the Dow. It was down mainly 2 points, 18,352. The NASDAQ was up 6, 51.66. S&P didn't even make it a full point, 21.64. So again, it's like nobody traded today. It just all, let's just wait until tomorrow, and we'll save it for tomorrow. 10-year yield, 1.50%. The euro, a little pressure, 111. Of course, the European and Japanese markets were strong overnight. London was, especially after the news that came out later on in their trading day. We'll talk about that a little bit. I just wanted to make a little bit. This is my little segment for the election. We still got about, 3 months, 90 days, something like that, till the election. A new Rasmussen report poll came out, telephone and online survey, and they found that Clinton had 44% support. Donald Trump had 40%. Fox had a 10-point lead for Hillary earlier in the day. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, whatever you think of polls, I don't have much faith in polls. You can make them read whatever you want them to. Trump did make it an issue for his campaign. It was always about the polls. And, but I think you're going to see this go back and forth on these polls until the debates. And I think the debates are going to be important this year. I think the debates will probably, when the debates are said and done, there will be a clear winner. And, of course, you know, we talk about the debates and having a clear winner, but and I think after the second debate, you'll probably know. But, of course, you have to eliminate any rigging. You always have to put that into the equation, the rigging of the elections, because, you know, it can go anyway then. But so, again, it's going to be kind of, it'll probably be a little boring until these debates. And because you've got the Olympics going on, so there's going to be a lot of other distractions. And I think the election, the presidential elections are going to have a little bit of a backseat. I know the election for Paul Ryan is being heated up. And I read today where even his own Facebook page is not very complimentary to his views and you know, his likings to Obama's policies of late. So, reason Europe was up, particularly London. I think Britain has a new battle cry. Whatever it takes. I mean, they are at that moment that they will do whatever it takes to try and keep their economy afloat. Mark Carney unleashed a package of stimulus, including the Bank of England's first interest rate cut in 7 years. He also said that more easing could come as Britain feels the effects of its decision to leave the European Union. You know, the Brexit could be, you know, the excuse. I still think the Brexit was a big deal. I don't think it was a knee-jerk reaction big deal. But I think in the longer term, you're going to see things that perhaps will point to that decision. And again, it could be a year down the road, the knee jerk, the immediate, no, these elite, you know, the status quo, the elite, the elitists, they have visions of, you know, what's going to happen a year, 2 years, 10 years. They're very patient. And so many, folks find that a little bit difficult to, see beyond, you know, today or tomorrow. And but they do. And so I think their battle cry is whatever it takes. Officials led by the Bank of England governor voted to reduce the benchmark by 25 basis points to a record low, 0.25%. We're also going to continue with the purchases of corporate bonds. They're going to do a lending program for banks. Purchases of gilts, that's all going to continue. They took these steps because the economic outlook has changed markedly. That's what Carney told reporters in London today. He says indicators have all fallen sharply, in most cases to levels last seen in the financial crisis, and in some cases to all-time lows, which means it's far worse than the financial crisis. Not just last seen, but if you have all-time lows, that means it's worse than the financial crisis. We talk about several reports on this program. And it's like, well, you hadn't seen these numbers since 2007. You haven't seen these numbers since 2008. This is the point. We're just right back to where we were because they didn't do anything to fix anything. The monetaries, you know, they talk about the 60 billion pounds of government bonds over 6 months they're planning on buying, 10 billion pounds of corporate bonds and so forth and whatnot. Should their outlook for the economy prove correct, majority of members expect to support a further cut in bank rate to its effective lower bound later this year. This is what they said in a statement. Carney has said multiple times that this doesn't mean rates will be negative. I kind of find that funny. I mean, they're at 0.25. You know, if they cut it any more to support the economy, yeah, it'll go to zero. But hey, that's not negative. He also said, Carney said he's not a fan of negative interest rates. He added, noting that they had produced negative consequences elsewhere. So, you know, they don't consider that zero to be negative, you know, so they still have room to cut. And that doesn't mean the rates will be negative. So yeah, I found that kind of funny. But so again, we saw the larger gain, almost 2% in London. And the point of that was this is what they were expecting. And hey, they're almost at zero. They're almost at negative. And I'll guarantee you some of their bonds are probably in the negative territory. Donald Trump, he vows to spend twice as much as Hillary Clinton to fix America's roads, bridges, and internet capacity. Clinton had a plan for, she states she has a plan for $275 billion to spend over 5 years. Trump says he's going to do the same. At least it will cost at least double that. He says you're going to really need more than Clinton's plan, he said on Tuesday. We have bridges that are falling down. I agree with Mr. Trump, but it will cost much more than the Clinton's $275 billion. But I also believe it will be more than what Trump is estimating. Our infrastructure repairs will be probably closer to $1 trillion when all said and done. The one thing we know about infrastructure spending is it's going to happen. This came from an economist, Peter Morici, out of the University of Maryland. I don't know if it's going to happen. They might attempt to address the infrastructure. It certainly needs to be addressed. It certainly needs to be funded. It certainly needs. A lot of these areas need to be fixed, but there just isn't any money to do it. Come March 17th of next year, I think that's the date. It's March. I'm pretty sure it's the 17th. I mean, we're getting closer to the day of reckoning. It's approaching. You know, the debt issue, the debt ceiling. Does anybody remember the debt ceiling? Does anybody remember that there's unlimited? I mean, can you even imagine what some of these numbers will be and how it will be addressed come March 2017 into the new presidency? And so, folks, it's going to be a bumpy road. It's going to be a real bumpy road. Clinton says that she would raise taxes on businesses to fund the spending. She would also start with an infrastructure bank. That's basically a public-private partnership where the government puts in some money and private investors put in the rest. I mean, how dumb could you be? You know, even Trump proposes infrastructure bonds that people and investors would buy. He also mentioned setting up an infrastructure fund. Why would anybody want to invest in infrastructure bonds when our country is already bankrupt? I mean, I get it, but we do have a dire situation of our infrastructure. The problem is how to pay for it. And I don't want to pay for it, but they're expecting any taxpayer, all taxpayers, to chip in the probably closer to $1 trillion to fix our infrastructures. I've been trying to get to this report all week long. It's really not a report. It's comments from this particular person. It was pretty much an accumulation of financial events and statements occurring last week. There was a lot of things that went on last week, and yet there was no reactions. And, you know, I learned a long time ago where there's an action, you have to have a reaction. Well, there's always lots of actions going on, but no reactions to anything, particularly in the financial markets. One of the most common questions I get asked is, you know, what time frame do I expect to see gold and silver prices rise? When are the stock markets going to collapse? And the other one is, when is the purging of the world monetary system going to take place? No one knows these dates and times. As we talk here every day on this program, no one on this planet or any other planet knows when the system is going to break. There will be no warning bell out there telling you when to get out of the market. It's not like, you know, the weatherman knowing that a tornado is approaching and there's a siren that's telling you to seek shelter. There isn't going to be a warning siren. If you're expecting a pre-notification, this program, we're basically doing it for you now. We are going to be this is the best notification that you're going to get is by, this is what we've been telling you. We are the notification. We are that warning bell. We are that siren. But we're not at the total collapse when it actually happens. There was a Bloomberg article written by Sri Kumar, and he writes about the warning bell. He says that there isn't going to be one. And he talked about last week where the Fed declared that the economy was on an improving track. Things were good. And this was just a couple of days before the GDP data was released on Friday, showing that the U.S. posted the weakest recovery since the Second World War. Not just since the financial crisis of 2008, but the worst recovery since the Second World War. The Bank of Japan, everyone expected, widely expected to ease further. Instead, it kept its negative rate and monthly bond purchases unchanged. The yen surged, and the Bank of Japan made no move toward any helicopter money, despite a recent visit by the Federal Chairman Ben Bernanke. Extremely weak UK economy numbers led a rate cut by the Bank of England today. I just mentioned it just a little bit ago. But last week, major British banks, with the thought of it, threatened to charge commercial depositors for holding their cash. You know, the developments are all the more remarkable in that there was no significant sign of a change in policy anywhere in the world toward less focus on monetary policy and greater emphasis on job creation, tax reforms, or labor market flexibility. The second notable feature is that none of these factors appear to have affected the overall equity markets. The S&P index rose to new highs during July, ending the month up 3.5%. The surge in U.S. equity prices was especially notable because forecasts of corporate earnings have been declining every quarter. The 10-year note, the yield, rose to a high, 160 in July, but fell back 15 basis points by the month's end. And despite all the post-Brexit uncertainty, the FTSE 100 rose by 3.3% last month. You know, where there's actions, there's no reactions. It's an incredible illusion. These major central banks, you know, there's no investor in this whole planet that thinks that the major central banks will eventually produce an economic turnaround. There is no economic turnaround coming our way or anybody's way. Monetary authorities just keep adding liquidity, even as more and more sovereign and corporate obligation yield negative returns. The lack of alternatives pushes investors into equities. And they're getting more riskier because they need that return. So there is no shining light among any global economy, not in the U.S., Europe, Japan, China. But you still have investors piling into equities and hope that the central bankers will provide an unending stream of liquidity. I wouldn't want to bet on that. But so far, there is no sign that the central banks are backing away from policies that have not worked in the years since the global financial crisis. We talk about it all the time. What economies have really benefited from all of the stimulus these global banks have been putting into this in the global financial crisis? But have these policies not worked? And we'll might have to talk about this tomorrow. Maybe they have worked for the elite. They have been able to keep the monetary system functioning, not to the benefit of you and me and every other middle-class citizen of other countries, but just maybe they were successful in promoting their agenda and creating a world event, a financial world event, to usher in their world government. So I do believe, you know, there isn't anything they can do, and they will continue to funnel the stimulus and do what is necessary, and there will be no warning bells to ring to tell you to get out of the paper in time. 1-800-375-4188. We will tell you to get out of the paper, so give us a call. We'll tell you how to transfer those worthless notes or soon-to-be worthless notes into something that's real, like gold and silver. 1-800-375-4188. Stay tuned. Alfred and James will be here in just a few short moments.
Job stress, financial obligations, or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at the 3Ws.thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now. American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices. I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Our guest is James Corbett, calling in from Japan. He is the author and mastermind behind thecorbettreport.com, a website for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. He's also editorial writer for the International Forecaster, and a regular guest on this program. Hello, James. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well, and I like that idea of titling myself a mastermind.
Well, you have my permission to use it all you want.
Thank you.
We've got a bunch of stories, and one of the themes or tonight's questions may be, is the world really in as much trouble as it seems to be if you read the media, or are some of our headlines being hyped? For example, here's something from the Daily Mail in the United Kingdom. It says, Merkel on the ropes. Thousands of German protesters take the streets saying, she must go. All right? Merkel's partnership is hanging by a thread as thousands gathered to call for resignation, while a key political ally dramatically withdrew his support for over immigration policy. 5,000 protests in Berlin, 4 brutal terrorist attacks that have left 13 dead in the last month. Chancellor faced a fresh wave of fury after it emerged that 2 recent terror attacks and the 3rd killing were carried out by men who entered the country as refugees. Is Merkel really in big trouble, or is this just another blip?
You know, you ask a very insightful question, because it is so easy to get caught up in whatever the news story of the moment is that we lose all perspective. And that is something that was really, truly it still is understood by people who work in media, but obviously they can play with people's perceptions in order to increase viewership and increase clicks and increase advertising revenue. So that is one of the motivations for creating the 24/7 emergency kind of feeling in the public. Let's look at the terrorism issue as an example. Back in even the 70s in the United States, where you had terrorist bombings that were being perpetrated by Puerto Rican separatists that were not they weren't made a big deal of or advertised or talked about endlessly in the media, because the media understood that if you talk about these types of things, that is exactly what the terrorists want. You are playing into their agenda by basically advertising their acts of terrorism. Whereas, of course, when you look at anything, I mean, the classic example is look at how many people die on the streets every single day in the United States in car accidents versus the number of people who die every day in terrorist incidents. It isn't even close. If you had as much attention on or a proportional amount of attention on the car-related deaths as you do terrorism deaths, terrorism wouldn't even make a blip in the headlines. So it really is a question of what you get people to focus on. And another perfect reflection of this is crime rates, violent crime rates, still at multi-decadal lows, yet still there is the increasing presence of the police forces in people's daily lives and the ever-increasing need for more militarized police. Why is that? Why is crime rates still, even though there was a slight rise in violent crime rates in urban centers last year, still very much below where they were, say, in the 1990s, and yet people are probably more scared now than they ever have been about violent crime and things of that nature. Again, it is media perception that creates these types of... They don't create the problem, but they create the media,
the
panic in the public. Exactly, exactly.
And the question here, you know, the old saying in the media, if it bleeds, it leads. All right, your first story on the media is somebody got shot, killed, whatever, on TV. That might not have been true, but there was a point to it. There was a certain amount of truth to it. Who is writing these headlines? Are they being written by just the media for the purpose of simply amping up, look, someone shot at Hillary Clinton? All right, well, they shot a spitball at her, all right? But the headlines, shot at Hillary Clinton. Okay, everybody's going to read that article. Is that done simply because the newspaper outlet, they want to attract more attention, get people to look at the stories so they can look at the ads and they can make more money? Is it just for that, or is this something that's being orchestrated by government where they're trying to keep us in a state of hypertension?
I think it isn't just the sensationalism and the clickbait and the advertising revenue. But I do think that does provide a certain motivation. I think to a certain extent, also, the medium is the message, and the medium of the internet is creating that type of BuzzFeed news environment where it is the most sensational and outrageous headline that people generally tend to go with in order to get people's attention. That plays into it. But I think there is also the underlying deeper agenda of creating societal tensions As I really do think the divide and conquer strategy of the culture wars in the United States specifically that have been going on for decades and talked about for decades, I think are really starting to come to a head because they are being amplified. They are being promoted at this point by the media. And I don't think that can just be due to sensationalism and you know, advertising revenue. I think there has to be at some point some sort of agenda to promote the tensions in society. And this is ramping up. I mean, it's certainly not winding down at this point. And it's coming to a head, of course, with the 2016 election, which, whichever way it goes, will only further serve to fan those flames.
We talk about the internet being conducive to this. I understand that, or at least I think I can understand it from the perspective that the internet is such an incredibly competitive environment. They have programs that will identify if somebody's selling shirts for a nickel less than you can buy them at JCPenney's, we'll go over and buy them for JC. We'll buy them and save the nickel. They have programs that identify this. The competition is extraordinary on the internet, unlike anything the world has probably ever seen before. It necessarily, with that competition, it necessarily inclines people to exaggerate. Oh my gosh, somebody shot Hillary Clinton. Yeah, it was with a bean blower. All right, we'll get into that in the article. But the headline, get those eyes on that extraordinary competition is at least part of the reason for the exaggeration that we'll see in headlines. Is the media the message? You know, I sit here and I wind up watching the internet. I'll bet you that I'm on the internet 6-8 hours a day. I can remember as a child and a young man, you watched the evening news for maybe 20 minutes a day. Take out the commercials, you might get 25 minutes of news every day. And oh my gosh, did you see what Walter Cronkite said? That was all we had. And then we went to CNN or whoever it was, it started out with just a 24-hour news day. News, 24 hours a day. Internet, news, 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 news. I mean, it comes at you like water out of a fire hydrant. It's hard to get a drink. You see what I'm saying here?
Oh, I absolutely do. Yes, the information overload, which is one of the defining parts of the era that we're living in. Yeah. And, I mean, it's certainly it's not something that hasn't been foreseen. I mean, this has been written about for decades now. In fact, going back nearly half a century at this point, people were writing about what essentially would become the internet, this era of online networked information environments where people could instantaneously communicate. That's been envisioned for quite a while and talked about.
Are you talking about McLuhan?
Not just McLuhan. There have been a number of writers that have talked about this.
Okay.
Brzezinski wrote about Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era, talking about the start of these. And there was a philosopher whose name I'm going to forget at the moment, but I studied him in my European philosophy of the 20th century course back in university nearly two decades ago now. Talking basically about this and talking about it half a century ago, this has been foreseen. And the effects are pretty much what one would expect from that. There is such a phenomenon as information overload, and it does cause people to turn to opinion makers for their opinions. There's so many facts coming out that people need a way to sort through the facts. They need a narrative to grasp on and try to filter through all of these facts. And that need for a narrative, I think, is probably stronger now than it's ever been before. Think back to my childhood, let alone some of the older people in the crowd, without this 24/7 online news environment, you have time to read a book and stop and stare off into space and think about that book and what the ideas. I don't have that space for personal reflection at this point, and I'm as guilty as anyone else of scrolling through the Twitter feed. Oh, what else is? It is truly we rewire our brains. I actually just had a conversation about this with a practicing research psychologist talking about the way smartphones are really starting to shape people's behavior in ways that are absolutely 100% in line with class addiction symptoms. And it's starting to affect the way that we process the world, basically. And I don't think that's a good thing. And some of this, I think, is part of an agenda. It certainly does feed into an agenda, but some of it really is the nature of the technology itself.
Anyone in control of the
I'm sorry, I think you're breaking up. I had a hard time hearing you.
I know you are. You break.
Hello?
I can hear you. Look, hear me.
All right. Well, it looks like Al may be having some technical difficulties. It looks like I'm here. So on the point that I was just making about the envisioning of this new networked world, again, we can look back to, for example, Zbigniew Brzezinski in Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era, published in 1970, which is 46 years ago now. He wrote specifically about the changes that would be coming to democratic society as a result of technocracy, and he wrote, quote, "Another threat, less overt but no less basic, confronts liberal democracy. More directly linked to the impact of technology, it involves the gradual appearance of a more controlled and directed society. Such a society would be dominated by an elite whose claim to political power would rest on allegedly superior scientific know-how. Unhindered by the restraints of traditional liberal values, this elite would not hesitate to achieve its political ends by using the latest modern techniques for influencing public behavior and keeping society under close surveillance and control. Under such circumstances, the scientific and technological momentum of the country would not be reversed, but would actually feed on the situation it exploits," which is a fascinating summary of where we stand as a society today, and yet this was written nearly half a century ago as a warning, quote unquote, but I think we know which side of the coin Brzezinski and his ilk would fall on in the question of democracy versus technocracy, even if democracy per se was something that we wanted. Certainly it is against the interests of the masses to have a society where we are increasingly subjected to this type of influencing of public behavior. And how do you influence public behavior? You influence public perception. And exactly as I was talking about earlier, it is public perception that is the key here. It is the creation and molding of an understanding about where we are as a society in terms of the crisis events. What are the real problems we're facing? And if the only problems we're being shown are, you know, this terror event that killed three people on the other side of the world, rather than things that are directly influencing your daily life, it will start to change your behavior itself.
You know, when I get up in the mornings, first thing I do is I've got to get on the internet and see if there's, I'm afraid I'm going to miss something. You know, I'm almost afraid to go to sleep at night because, oh my gosh, something's going to happen and I won't get it on the internet within the first 30 seconds after the news reports it. I am subject to the addiction. You were talking about the technology, I think if I understood you correctly, you were referring to someone who was saying that our advancement in technology depends on our technology. That's not exactly a surprise. But if we back away from the technology on the internet, we are likely to fall back. The implication may be that if we try to resist the force of the internet, we will not advance technologically as quickly as we might, and we surrender wealth, power, prosperity to, who knows, China, India, whoever. Where do you rest? You know, where do you find a place? It's like you were saying, where you just read a book, stare off into space once in a while. Watch
it's
the birds
a good
fly by.
Yeah,
yeah, where do you get any rest right now? And it isn't on the internet. The internet's, it should sell a lot of coffee, if nothing else. We're going to take a break for some commercials. I'm Alfred Addis here with James Corbett, our guest, and we will be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned.
To hormone imbalance. And when this happens, men can experience osteoporosis, memory loss, irritability, blood sugar imbalance, weight gain, enlarged prostate, erectile dysfunction, and risk of stroke. The human endocrine system manufactures hormones. Why not feed your system plant nutrition to make the hormones that are right for you? For centuries, these herbs have been used to balance the male hormone system. Men, you've waited long enough for the male hormone formula. Call Apothecary Herbs toll-free 866-229-3663 for the male hormone formula. 866-229-3663 or online at thepowerherbs.com. 866-229-3663, where your healthcare options just became endless.
Prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
I'm Alfred Addis here with our guest James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. I've got an article here from Information Clearinghouse, and the headline is America's Longest War Gets Longer. One thing that amazed me, and this is the author's opinion, this isn't mine exactly, one thing that amazed me was America's lack of attention to America's longest ever war. It still rages in the mountains of Afghanistan. We've been there for 13 years. What are we doing in Afghanistan? How is it that we can't either win the war or walk away from it? Are we going to be trapped there for the next century? What is happening in Afghanistan? Well, James, here's that one of us is here and one of us is not. Frank, if you are listening, Frank.
Sorry about that. I think I had a bit of technical difficulty there. I'm back. Hi.
Okay. All right. Did you hear what I? Did you hear my question?
Yes, I did. And I would just correct, not 13 years, 15 years now.
All right, 15 years.
Yeah.
See how the time flies.
Yes. Obviously, I think it, well, it should be obvious by this point, I would hope, that the intention was never to do some quick surgical strike, remove Al-Qaeda, which we'll try to remember what's ostensibly the reason for this invasion in the first place, because Al-Qaeda had some training camps in this country. We're going to invade and bomb the smithereens out of the whole country, right? And then get out of there once that's mission accomplished. Wait, but at least officially, Osama's dead for 5 years now in Pakistan. What are they doing in Afghanistan now? Clearly, the intention was never to just invade and leave. The intention was always to put a permanent American military presence right there in that extremely important area of the chessboard. Obviously, with the ability to project outward into the Middle East, also into Central Asia, Afghanistan has been historically an exceptionally important geographical space for any would-be power to occupy, and the American Empire is no different. 150 years ago, it was the great game between Russia and the Great Britain, and Afghanistan was a central part of that great game. In this current day and age, it is still, essentially, it's the Anglo-American power and versus Russian influence, Chinese influence in the region, and that's exactly why they want their toehold in there.
It seems hard to believe that Afghanistan is such an important piece on the chessboard, because it's impoverished. It's largely just a big stack of rocks, rocks on rocks on rocks. At least that's the impression we have in this country, and yet we are fighting to stay. I think it might have been Brzezinski, I don't remember, but whoever first came up with the idea that Afghanistan was critical to world domination, world power, whatever. Is that guy really a genius, or was he some sort of an idiot? Is this true? Are we doing this because it's real, or are we doing this because we think it's real?
I think it is real. To a certain extent, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So just the creation of the interest in a region creates real interest, which then creates real conflict. But I think there has been historically importance to that region. And the first, well, one of the first formulations of this was, in fact, Mackinder, I forget, was it Alfred Mackinder, wrote about this 100-plus years ago now, talking about the World Island, which is what he called the Eurasian landmass, all of that area that connects all the way from Europe all the way over to East Asia. That landmass is the central part of the globe that needs to be controlled by any would-be ruling power. And the central part of that world island was this area that encompasses Central Asia, moving upward into Eastern Europe. That part is so extremely important. And as, now, of course, there are other reasons why we would say in the early 21st century why that area is important, including, of course, access to the Caspian Sea and the Persian Gulf, both of which obviously have extensive resources. Afghanistan itself, although it is an impoverished nation, is certainly not just a bunch of rocks. In fact, it's been called the Saudi Arabia of lithium, with an estimated $1 trillion of lithium deposits, which is certainly nothing to sneeze at, which was apparently just discovered by the USGS 5 or 6 years after they invaded. Hey, who knew? Who could have guessed, right?
But get lucky or what?
There are resource reasons, but also Afghanistan is smack dab in that region, right between the Middle East and Central Asia. Right there in the heart of it, and obviously on the doorstep of China, and not too far from Russia and its interests in Central Asia with Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan. It's an extremely important square to occupy. And if NATO has a toehold in Afghanistan, which they do, then they have Iran completely surrounded and they have it contained. And Iran, of course, is a stepping stone toward China and Russia.
What is our real relationship with Iran right now? Do we have the impression that President Obama has tried to make a better relationship with Iran? Has he succeeded? Can he succeed? Or is this just wishful thinking?
I think there really has been a shift in recent years that has been somewhat to the benefit of Iran, with the concluding of not just the nuclear deal. Now they're talking about this apparently hundreds of millions of dollars that was secretly sent to Iran, basically as presumably as a payoff for the hostages that were released earlier this year. So there's some sort of shady shenanigans about that. And whether or not the Obama administration is really cozying up to Iran, that is certainly the impression that it is being given. And that is what Saudi Arabia is taking out of all of this, which is part of the reason why Saudi Arabia is so mad with the United States. And there is such tension between Saudi and the U.S. right now, which, again, as we've talked about before, is an extremely important thing because the Saudi-U.S. relationship is part of the backbone of the U.S. dollar itself with the petrodollar recycling scheme. So this has implications not just for the U.S., or not just for the Middle East, I mean literally for the globe and the way that the monetary system itself is ordered. So there's some pretty big moves afoot, and I would be flabbergasted if whatever president comes in November maintains that type of stance towards Iran. I'm assuming that things are going to flip around again and Iran is going to become the demon of choice in that area.
Speaking of Saudi Arabia, an article from Zero Hedge, and the headline is Saudi banks offered $4 billion bailout to avoid liquidity crisis. Bloomberg is reporting that the Saudi Arabian Monetary Agency, the Saudi Central Bank, has offered domestic lenders $4 billion in discounted one-year loans to ease liquidity constraints in an effort to avoid a full-blown banking crisis. Is Saudi Arabia in deep economic trouble right now? Venezuela has collapsed because the price of oil has fallen. Is Saudi Arabia in that kind of trouble, or potentially can we see it 6 months or a year from now? Or is this much ado about nothing?
Oh, I think it's much ado about something. I think that the pain that Saudi Arabia has been feeling in recent years is very real. And I think that they are, I mean, this is why they're starting to do the previously unthinkable things, like starting to offload part of Saudi Aramco and things like that, which have been the basis of the Saudi government and its position and its power. They wouldn't do something like that unless there's writing on the wall for the future of their economic health. And I think that's starting to be felt. And there were some stories, I think it was earlier this year, recently, that the Saudi liquidity crisis, the Saudi government's liquidity crisis was such that they were going to have to start paying contractors with debt rather than with actual money, because they just do not have the liquidity to pay. So I think that there is a real liquidity crisis going on right now. And Saudi is definitely feeling the economic pinch right now.
Are they in danger? Because I'm going to assume this liquidity crisis will continue as long as the price of oil remains low, crude oil. How long can the price of crude oil remain in the neighborhood of $40 a barrel?
That is an excellent question. I think it's already outperformed my expectations for this year. I wasn't even expecting it to get to the 40-50 range until probably the end of the year. So it's already starting to come back up, but there are still ongoing structural problems with the idea of oil coming back to what it was before, including the fact that no one can afford to stop pumping. And we've seen this. We've seen all of these threats. Oh, okay, OPEC's going to get their act together. They're going to start doing an oil cut. But they have not done so yet, and I don't think that they're able to. And Saudi Arabia is in the position with the liquidity crisis. They can't afford to stop pumping either. So the old controls on that market have come off, and it really is an open question. There's still, of course, always the possibility of some form of crisis causing crisis prices. Some sort of event in Syria or some sort of invasion or, you know, whatever one can envision that would cause upset in the region and a destabilization of the flow of oil into the markets. And we could see a return to, you know, some sort of major spike. But barring that, there are structural problems still with the oil markets. And I think to a certain extent, maybe the genie is off the bottle and maybe OPEC can't get its magic back together and get everyone on board again, because everyone has their own interests. And places like Venezuela and Russia, they're all undergoing their own economic problems of various sorts that mean they cannot stop pumping.
I mean, not only that they can't stop pumping, but some people suspect that they can't withstand, they can't fight new pumping. from other countries, and I'm referring to Libya, who allegedly at least announced they were going to begin to start pumping again. And about the same time, they wound up getting bombed.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly right.
Is this a coincidence? Are these two events unrelated, pumping? Oh, we're going to start pumping, and the government says we're going to start bombing. Are these just coincidence, or are they cause and effect?
Well, even if they're not directly related, which I certainly think they could be, but even if it isn't that simply a direct relation, it's still generally the case that obviously the bombing and destabilization of Libya is what led to the rise of ISIS generally, of course, and also ISIS specifically in Libya, which is leading to the bombing. So it all comes around full circle, and it all has created the destabilization of the Libyan oil production. And, of course, that is continuing as the country has really broken into at least three pieces. There are at least now three governments that officially proclaim to be the government of Libya, and none of them really control the entire country. So it really is a failed state at this point, and a failed state has a lot of problems, you know, getting oil flowing in the way that it used to. So whether or not, again, this is a direct consequence, it certainly is the sort of bigger picture of the linking of those events, and something that I think, again, plays into the hands of people that were concerned about Chinese investment in Africa generally, and of course their close relationship with Libya. Again, I'll note that one of the first targets of these rebels in the east of Libya that started all of this back in 2011, where it was the Chinese oil companies, and they were some of the first targets of these rebels. And one of the second targets was to create a new central bank. Interesting how, you know, those rebels had their priorities in order.
Hey, you. When Gaddafi was in control, Colonel Gaddafi was in control of Libya, they had the highest standard of living in Africa. And I think what this was a function, it had to be a function of, they pumped the oil and they gave generous portions of the profits to the Libyan people. And I would guess that's what allowed him to control a significant number of different factions. Right now it's broken down into three separate factions. Will these factions ever be healed unless they start pumping again and generating huge profits and sharing those profits with the public?
Well, Libya is a tribal society. It has only cohered as a country because of the, iron fist / velvet glove of people like Gaddafi. And that certainly did keep a coherence in the society. Not, of course, everyone was happy, perfectly happy with the former government, but it was at least a workable relationship. At this point, once that has been smashed, I'm not sure that the pieces will fit back together. I'm not sure Libya does cohere as a country, as a nation state, because it is a tribal society that's split many different ways. And if there is a chance of putting it together, I don't see how that's going to happen in the near term, and I don't see how it's going to happen with the so-called unity government in Tripoli that the U.S. is supporting with its bombing raids. And the U.S. can now proclaim from on high to be, oh, well, we're not necessarily picking sides here. We're just making sure that the terrorists don't gain a foothold in the country. But by bombing certain parts of the country at certain times at the request of the unity government, you are effectively backing them up. And when they start warring with the other parts, the other governments that claim to have control, then you're at least backing them up, if not directly aiding them. So you are picking favorites and you are picking which way it goes, which shouldn't be a surprise. But it's good to keep in mind that this mess was all created by the so-called humanitarian intervention, which really was just a mask for the agenda, which was to destabilize, to get rid of Gaddafi and to destabilize the country. And in that case, mission accomplished.
And presumably to destroy the Pan-African gold-based currency that Gaddafi had in mind and was apparently getting close to implementing.
There were a number of projects that I think this successfully derailed. The gold dinar is one of them. The idea of creating irrigation using the massive underground water supplies in Libya, a massive public works project was planned to create a garden in the desert, which was the way it was being touted. That, of course, has come to a crashing halt, that kind of ambitious project. And, yes, the African Union was becoming more of a coherent entity, and Gaddafi was an important part of that. He also gave a pretty important speech several months before he started getting targeted, in which he basically said, you know, there are two main competitors for investment or exploitation of Africa at this time. It is the U.S. and China. And
we're
going
to have to let it go with that, James. I have to say thank you for being on the program again, as always. Enjoyed it. Insightful, informative, educational. We'll be back in 2 weeks with James Corbett from the Corbett Report. I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival. I want to thank all of you for listening. Good night.
I work all day.